You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Well, I hope everybody is rejuvenated after your cookies and coffee. And we're now going to have the last panel of the day, which is opportunities and challenges for the new context in U.S.-Taiwan mainland China relations. And we have a terrific panel. I'm going to ask everybody to please speak for just the 10 to 12 minutes. And we still have a timekeeper in front who will be giving you signals if you are going over. So our first speaker to my immediate right is Dr. Huang Kuo-bo, who is Secretary General of the Association of Foreign Relations and a Professor of Diplomacy and International Relations at National Zhengzhi University, and of course, importantly, a prior visiting fellow in the Center for East Asia Policy Studies at the Brookings Institution. So we'll start with you, Dr. Huang.
Okay. Thank you, Bunny. And it's great to come back again to meet all of you with interest in cross-strait relations and U.S.-Taiwan mainland China relations. I have only 12 minutes, so I'll try to focus on just two big issues in the realms of economics and of politics. But I think it's a little bit difficult to elaborate on these two big issues within very limited time. So please allow me to say something first on economics, then followed by politics with just a few points I would like to make or to stress. First of all, I think, the general picture in my mind is that actually in the region of Asia-Pacific, geographic conflicts or military conflicts have decreased, being replaced by economic and trade cooperation. Therefore, we have seen a lot of economic integration or cooperation games, such as RCEP or TPP or AIIB, as mentioned earlier, and also issues or initiatives like Silk Road Fund or FTAAP under APEC. We have had so many different integration or cooperation games going on in the region of Asia-Pacific, which has occupied a lot of countries' attention, draw a lot of countries' attention. Therefore, I think the main theme for the future Taiwan-U.S. mainland China relations might be going to focus a little bit more on economics than politics or the military dimension. Okay. Let me say a little bit about the point I would like to make on the economic dimension. First, I think from a Taiwan's perspective, you know, Taiwan wants to be seen on the economic strategy radar screen of the U.S. and of mainland China. You know, that could bring some salience to Taiwan's importance in these two countries, in these two parties' economic strategies. However, I think the U.S. and mainland China would have perceived Taiwan differently. The U.S. would see Taiwan as an indispensable, important player that is in need of greater participation in probably U.S.-favored economic cooperation regimes in the region. But I also know that maybe the U.S. doesn't think Taiwan has performed satisfactorily in this economic cooperation game. But in the eyes of mainland China, I think mainland China always views Taiwan as a non-sovereign entity. And whenever Taiwan would like to participate in any regional economic cooperation regime or institution, Taiwan should have asked Beijing, or at least Taiwan should have sent a heads up to Beijing, not just meeting other countries' representatives for approval. So I think that's one of the things that Beijing has shown big concern about. Also, I think in the eyes of Beijing, it's of great importance that Taiwan's participation in economic integration or cooperation in the region will not lead to China's or one China, one Taiwan. So even though Taiwan wants to be seen, but I think these are some, you know, limits faced by Taiwan. And my second point on this is that Taiwan needs badly, you know, to be involved in TPP and or RCEP. Taiwan's failure to participate in these economic institutions or cooperation will hurt Taiwan seriously. It will seriously damage Taiwan's economic competitiveness. So, but for U.S. and for mainland China, you know, I think they're not wanting Taiwan to join TPP or RCEP for now, you know, has different reasons. For U.S., I think U.S. Feels that Taiwan has a very slow move and uncertain determination in the modification of Taiwan's own domestic laws and regulations. If Taiwan fails to do that, then Taiwan cannot meet the high standards set in TPP. For mainland China, I think mainland China has bigger concern about any of Taiwan's international participation that can be used by the next president of Taiwan, Republic of China, as an asset against mainland China. So it is a possible scenario that after May 2016, Xi in Taiwan is opposed to mainland China's One China principle, or the so-called 1992 consensus. And Xi on mainland China, it's not Xi, Xi on mainland China will feel insecure for giving more international space to Taiwan, because that Taiwanese leader might, you know, take advantage of mainland China's openness and use that against Beijing. So it will be very complicated in 2016. Okay, and I would like to emphasize as my third point that an economically weak Taiwan is troublesome for U.S., but may be good for mainland China. I say so because I think for U.S., an economic weak Taiwan will put U.S. in a dilemma where it is forced to or it is expected to manage in a more proactive way its relations with people on the democratic Taiwan who have lost their economic robustness. And such economic robustness serves as an important basis for Taiwan facing a rising mainland China. So U.S. has to, you know, be forced or is expected by other peoples to help Taiwan manage this dilemma. And for mainland China, an economically weak Taiwan means that mainland China may be more able to refrain Taiwan from dealing with Taiwan's external relations by Taiwan's economic power or economic means, which may lead to a greater possibility of national reunification. That is why some people in Taiwan have argued that actually mainland China doesn't want to see Taiwan's, you know, participation in TPP and RCEP and mainland China might not be that eager to see a real progress in cross-strait economic cooperation, because if there's some real progress in Taiwan's participation in these economic regimes, fine. And especially with ECFA or with RCEP. However, if Taiwan fails to join these economic regimes, okay, if Taiwan fails, then but that doesn't hurt too much, you know, for mainland China's Taiwan policy, because then a weak Taiwan is easier for Beijing to manage its relations and to manipulate relations with a weaker Taiwan. And very limited time to talk about the politics. I think I only want to emphasize just one thing, that is status quo. I think status quo is not only a keyword, but also a magic word, guaranteeing stability and peace in the area. So whenever there might be a clash of interests, then a party or both parties or three parties said status quo, then peace. Okay, but I have to argue that what we see as status quo is actually defined by three parties, not only by the U.S., but also by Taiwan and by mainland China. And I myself see that Taiwan's definition and the U.S. definition come with a great degree of inclusiveness, mutual inclusiveness, while mainland China's definition is competing with Taiwan's and U.S. Okay, but I also think that if we really would like to maintain peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait, then probably there will be three auxiliary conditions. First, the U.S. Must abide by the Taiwan Relations Act and does not force Taiwan to take sides on many controversial or sensitive issues where U.S. and mainland China might have a clash. And second, I think Taiwan needs to exercise some self-restraint, not challenging the current status or arrangements explicitly or implicitly agreed by Washington and its friends or competitors or partners or dialogue partners, etc. That is, Taiwan should have its own voice. However, I think Taiwan should also listen to others, why the others think that things should be like this, not like the way Taiwan prefers. You know, I think both Taiwan and others should have some responsibility on this peace and stability in the region. So no single side should, you know, dominate the development of future relations or regional arrangements here. And three, is that mainland China should continue to embrace such political ambiguity that defines current relations between Beijing and Taipei, not trying to, you know, dominate the agenda, not trying to push Taiwan to accept the so-called One China principle single-handedly favored and embraced by Beijing. If the three auxiliary conditions can be met, then I think there's still hope, you know, for the continued peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait. Okay, I think I have one more minute and I can donate to anyone here at the panel. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Huang Kuibo. Our second speaker is Dr. Wang Yuengang, who is associate professor in the Department of Sociology at Western Michigan University and also has the distinction of having been at Brookings Center for East Asia Policy Studies as a visiting fellow. So over to you, Dr. Wang.
Thank you, Bunny, and I'd like to thank the Brookings, AFR, and CSIS for making this possible. And it's good to be back. I was here about 10 years ago with Richard, but at that time it was called CNAPS. But now the Northeast is becoming East, so that's a good sign because it's expanding to more areas of interest. So what I'm going to do today is to talk about three recent major developments in U.S.-China-Taiwan relations, and then I'll offer also three observations about the trend lines of what to expect in the years to come. And so over the past few years, we have seen three major developments in turn in this kind of, if you want to call it trilateral relations or not. First thing is that China's rising economic and military power is leading to a more assertive foreign policy in the region, especially in the Southeast, in South China Seas and also East China Seas. And second, the United States is rebalancing toward East Asia. And so it's sort of planning to put more military, economic, and also diplomatic resources to the region. And number three, Taiwan's economy, I think this dovetails with Kuebo's point about Taiwan's economy, is that it is becoming more and more dependent on China. And that has security implications for Taiwan. So on my first point, I'd like to go back to my original training in IR theory, and that is that what do we expect of the behaviors of a rising power? So in international relations, rising powers tend to do two things. First, they tend to expand interests abroad, and because improved capabilities foster greater ambitions. And once you have more capabilities, that means that you are going to project your power to more areas of the world. And second, rising powers will try to reshape the international order to better serve its interests. Some of the existing rules of the game may serve its interests and they will keep it, but if they don't, they will try to revise it or change it to their favor. And so these two expectations based on IR theory is bearing out in the case of China. First thing, what we see is that China is increasing its footprint everywhere in the world. You know, I just got back from a summer vacation with my family in Europe. So everywhere I went, there were Chinese tourists and signs in Chinese, right? And if you go to Africa, South America, everywhere, you'll see a lot of China's influence. So there's a natural outgrowth of China's rising economic power. But when that happens, the Chinese government will try to develop some capabilities to protect those overseas interests. And we are seeing these kind of things gradually to emerge. And so in the South China Sea, we see a lot of muscle flexing by Beijing, right? And especially land reclamation projects in the South China Sea. And there are satellite pictures that shows you how it is changing. And second, about rules of the game, China is not trying to overthrow all rules of the game, but it's trying to reshape the existing rules of the game to better serve its interest. So it has taken the initiatives in creating a number of international organizations. So AIIB, the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank that we have been talking about. And early on, there was this Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which India is going to become a formal member very soon. And number three, US rebalance, because Asia is going to be where the future is, and it's going to be the center of gravity in international politics. So the rebalance strategy has a very sound strategic logic to it. But the question for us is that whether it can be done, given what's happening in the Middle East. There's another force that keeps pulling the attention of the US government to the Middle East instead of China. So these are the two developments. And the third development is Taiwan's economic dependence on China. And it has becoming more and more. So if you look at a few numbers in terms of trade with China, China is now Taiwan's number one trading partner. And over 20% of Taiwan's foreign trade is with China. But compared to China, Taiwan only accounts for about 4% of China's total foreign trade. So there's kind of this kind of asymmetry you can see. And secondly, on foreign direct investment, FDI, about over 60% of Taiwan's FDI. These are official numbers. They go to China. So over 60% of Taiwan's FDI. That means that most of the money are going to China. So Foxconn and a lot of Taiwanese companies, They are all invested in China. And but it's not the other way around. There were some Chinese investment, but those are still very a small percentage. And so this kind of economic dependence on China is creating a deep-seated anxiety within Taiwan. And so a survey in 2014 shows that 55.7% of the Taiwanese residents fear that China might use Taiwan's economic dependence to ask for political concessions. And that kind of concern, you can see, it was reflected in the Sunflower Movement in March last year, right? There's kind of this kind of concern about what do we do if our economy is becoming more and more dependent on China, will China use it against us? And that's the kind of concern. So these three developments, China's rising assertiveness and U.S. rebalance, Taiwan's economic dependence, the common denominator we can see is China's rising power. Compared to 10 or 20 years ago, China today is becoming the number two economic power and also the number two military spender in the world. It wasn't so 10 years ago or 20 years ago, right? And so based on this, we can observe a few trend lines in U.S.-Taiwan-China relations. First thing is that U.S.-China relations will become more competitive. And we are seeing a lot of indications of that recently. And so in the 90s, there were a lot of optimism. So we talk about engagement and then moving to a responsible stakeholder. But these buzzwords, I don't hear them often today, right? And what replaced it is an increased level of pessimism with regard to U.S.-China relations. And this has a lot to do with China's rising capabilities, because it's easier to talk about engagement, responsible stakeholder, when there's a large power gap between the United States and China. But today, the gap is narrowing, and that is going to make them more and more difficult. And that's the harsh reality of power politics. And secondly, in terms of U.S.-Taiwan relations, it seems to become more and more closer as a result. And although Taiwan is not officially part of the rebalance because of there's no official relations between Washington and Taipei, but there has seems to be more and more defense cooperation between the two countries. So one thing that a lot of people have been seeing is that maybe a recent AIT Facebook page, right, has a it's good timing. It has a picture of Taiwan's defense chief of staff attending a ceremony at the Pacific Command, right? We don't see that. Usually, we know that happened in the past, but they just don't, U.S. side just doesn't make it very public, but not now. And there's also a cooperation between Taiwan's Army Aviation Brigade and its counterpart in the U.S., and also a cooperation between a psychological warfare battalion in Taiwan and its counterpart in the U.S. And these are all in the public sphere today. And so a lot can be traced to the geographical value of Taiwan to the U.S., because if you look at the sea lines of communications locks, Taiwan is in an important part in East Asia, standing from Japan all the way to Southeast Asia. And the PLA also would like to control Taiwan, not for nationalist reason, but for strategic reason, because it's a breaking point of the PLA Navy. And so that kind of things will more likely to increase Taiwan's strategic value to the U.S. And I expect to see more cooperation on that side. And moving to cross-strait relations, we are entering a period of uncertainty because of the election in 2016. And the result will likely change the tone of great cross-strait relations. Right now, the Taiwan Strait is on the back burners of everything. Now, if we talk about East Asia, it's South China Sea, East China Sea, and Taiwan is relatively peaceful. But we don't know what will happen after 2016. Taiwan may come to the from burner again. We don't know, but there's certainly an uncertainty. And secondly, that if you look at what's happening within Taiwan again, there are at least two things that's happening. First, there's a rise of Taiwanese identity, and it has continued over the years. And today, over 60% of the residents on Taiwan identify themselves as Taiwanese only, not Chinese, but just Taiwanese only. 60%, think of that, that's more than 50%. And about 32% identify themselves as both Taiwanese and Chinese, only 32%. As to those who identify themselves as Chinese only, less than 5%, right? And so that's a big factor that's going to affect the future of cross-strait relations, that is the rising sense of Taiwanese identity. And secondly is this kind of dwindling support for unification. The support for unification, if you look at all the polls, is declining within Taiwan. And the survey over the years has one of my favorite questions is this: if the political, economic, and social conditions across the Taiwan Strait become compatible, would you support unification or not? Right? In the 90s, over 60% say yes, meaning that if the political, economic, and social conditions converge between China and Taiwan, most people would support unification. But the most recent survey done last year only say 27.9% will still support unification. So if you look at the trend lines, if you are Beijing, you'll be worried. It's not going in the direction that Beijing would like to see. And there's also a growing degree of impatience from Beijing about lack of political progress. Xi Jinping used to say that the political negotiation cannot be postponed generations after generations, right? He once said that. And so after 2016, what will Beijing do on the political front? We don't know. That's the wild card. And so to conclude my talk here is that what we are seeing here is that all the factors that we have seen is driving what's happening here is China's rising power, because the gap between U.S. and China is narrowing and is expected to continue to do so. So the two questions for us is that first, if China's power continues to rise and when the day comes that China is as powerful as the United States is today, what will happen, right? So will the U.S. accept an Asia in which U.S. influence is substantially diminished? That's a big question mark. Will the United States agree to become not number one again in Asia? And that's a big question for us to think about. And number two is that there's U.S. has a security commitment to Taiwan, although it's ambiguous according to the Taiwan Relations Act. But will the U.S. become unable to offer security assistance despite its will to do so when China is as powerful as the United States is? And that's the big question for us. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Wong. Our third speaker is Dr. Steve Goldstein, who is a professor of government at Smith College and the director of the Taiwan Studies Workshop at Harvard University. And I think he's going to talk to us all about different concepts of the term status quo, which Huang Kuibo also spoke about. So please, over to you, Steve.
I'm glad Bonnie said that, because this talk is not directed at Dr. Huang. I should begin by saying that. It's now approximately 1936 Greenwich Mean Time. The world is in status quo. As far as we can tell, New Horizons project, New Horizons progress towards Pluto suggests that the universe is in status quo. It's not a very helpful term. Status quo means things as they are. And yet status quo has become the phrase of the year in 2018, or 2015 rather. And it's you know, we talk about creating new status quos. We talk about accepting status quos. We talk about changing status quos. We talked today about improving status quos. We talked about status quo as a key word. And yet it's a very weak crutch to rely on. Status quo, again, simply means things as they are. And those of us who have worked in cross-strait issues are particularly aware of the nonsensical use of the term, because you've got three status quos, as the previous speaker suggested. So should we give up using the term status quo? and should we find some other term? What I'd like to suggest today is that we should keep status quo, but that we should define status quo as a conceptual framework that will make it dynamic and that will make it meaningful. And the way I'd like to do that is to suggest that status quo is really a spectrum. And it's a spectrum on the one hand from what I would call a stable status quo. And a stable status quo is a status quo where the actors accept the rules of the game, firstly, and secondly, they accept the rules of the game because the rules of the game are consistent with their aspirations. So status quo tends to be stable. At the other extreme of the spectrum is what I call a conflicted status quo. And that's a status quo where all of the actors, or some of the actors, believe that the existing situation does not serve their interests, and so they don't accept the norms of that status quo. Now, of course, what you're all asking is, what's the third status quo going to look like? And that's the status quo in the middle. And the status quo in the middle is one where the actors don't necessarily, where the actors don't necessarily believe that that situation is consistent with their ultimate goals, but they accept the norms. There's a slight paradox to that. So you've got to ask yourself, why would an actor accept the norms of a situation that doesn't meet its needs? And there could be three possibilities. One possibility could be that they believe that ultimately, if they stay in that kind of situation, that kind of status quo, that the status quo will evolve in a manner that is consistent with their needs. So they'll wait it out. A second possibility is that they believe that that status quo, while it won't ultimately lead to a satisfactory realization of their ultimate ends, it will at least start to get them there. And the third reason why an actor might accept the status quo, the norms of a status quo that are inconsistent with its goals, is because they have no choice, because there are constraints. There are external constraints that restrain them from doing so. Now, why, if you sort of take those three paradigms and you try to apply them to the situation as it exists in Asia, for example, it's pretty clear that the South China Sea and it's pretty clear that the East China Sea, that all of that tends on the spectrum to the conflicted side. The question is, where are the Taiwan Straits? Where is the situation between mainland China and Taiwan? And what is the future of that for American policy, which is what I was asked to talk about. And there we've got good news and bad news. The good news, as many speakers have said, is that the last 8 years have been some of the best years of cross-strait relations since 1949. That's the good news. The bad news is that the status quo that exists across the strait is not a stable status quo, is not a robust status quo. It's what I call an unstable status quo. Because there's one more characteristic of a status quo, of an unstable status quo that has to be introduced at this point. That characteristic is that it is no longer, it is not only rather, that the existing norms do not meet the ultimate goals of the actors. But what is more corrosive of an unstable status quo is the fact that not only don't the existing norms meet their ultimate aspirations, but on all sides in this triangle, there is a thread of reasoning that believes that the existing norms are actually eroding their ultimate goals, that by pursuing an unstable status quo, that by pursuing policies that are inconsistent with their ultimate goals, the actors are in fact eroding those ultimate goals. Let me make that more concrete. What are the ultimate goals of all the actors? Well, we know that. That's easy. The ultimate goal for the mainland is unification. The ultimate goal for Taiwan, both parties accept it, though they have very different readings of what it actually means. But the ultimate goal is to maintain the sovereignty of Taiwan and the autonomy from the mainland. That's in the party platforms, and it's also, of course, reflected in the public opinion. The ultimate goal of the United States, we've heard, is a peaceful Taiwan Straits. And that's true. But why a peaceful Taiwan Straits? And there I'd suggest that ever since John Foster Dulles and Dwight Eisenhower, the policy of the United States has been for there to be a peaceful Taiwan Straits so the United States can get out from being in the middle of a very unpleasant conflict between what began as a conflict between the communists and the nationalists. The real goal of the United States is not to be involved, to somehow have a situation in the Taiwan Straits that would not be embarrassing to the United States, that would not damage its national interests, but that would allow it to withdraw. So those are the ultimate goals. Now the question becomes, how have those ultimate goals been called under question by what has been going on for the last 8 years or so in terms of status quo in the Taiwan Straits? As far as the mainland's concerned, the China mainland has been very patient, clearly, and remains patient. But there are certainly signs ranging from statements by leaders to military drills to other activities or other statements that suggest that there's a degree of impatience also. As Xi Jinping said, that this should not be passed to another generation. There's a concern that Taiwan could be stalling and that could create a kind of peaceful unification. So as far as the mainland's concerned, to go on with this kind of status quo is tricky because it is allowing certain trends to develop on Taiwan that are not in the mainland's interest. As far as Taiwan is concerned, we've just heard in terms of trend lines, as far as Taiwan is concerned, both in regard to the political parties and in regard to public opinion, there's a concern that the current good relations with the mainland are in fact resulting in the entrapment of Taiwan. And that it's going to be it's going to end, this peaceful status quo is going to end in the eventual incorporation of Taiwan into the mainland. I'll try 1 minute, it might be two. Now, what about, now, the point is that I'm not saying that this is going to immediately lead to a conflict. What I am saying is what Richard and Alan said this morning, that these kinds of concerns about adverse effects of the current status quo, this could begin a spiral, and it could begin a descending spiral of crisis across the straits as each side reacts and the other side escalates. Now, what about the United States? We know the expression cork in the bottle, and we know Jim Lilly used that in reference to the ability of the Taiwan Navy to get out to the open ocean and Taiwan's importance as a cork in the bottle. But the United States is also the cork in the bottle. The participation of the United States in the relationship between China and Taiwan and the stated positions that we've heard that the United States takes is also something that modulates or clearly gives second thoughts to whatever either side might decide to do in this dangerous spiraling condition. So, in fact, the current status quo and the potential that it could have for this spiraling condition could, like Taiwan, like China, lead to policies that run counter to the American interest, which is not to live through George Marshall again. So, where does it end? My time is up. Where does it end, or how do I end? I think my focus is on American policy. My focus is on the trend lines, which are moving, status quo be damned. Trend lines are moving in a way that could be indicative of difficult days ahead. And what my concern is that from the perspective of the United States, what we're going through now is what I would call a debate within a debate. One of those debates is not so serious. The second debate, I think, is serious. The first debate is, what about Taiwan? Should we continue to maintain the relationship that we have with Taiwan? And you all know the names that I can mobilize as to people who have argued here in Washington that Taiwan is a albatross around the neck of the United States. That debate's not terribly serious. The debate that is serious is the debate about policy towards China, and is the TELUS, Blackwell, and the whole argument that the post-1972 policy has to be reevaluated and that we have to deal with Mersheimer's rising power. That's the serious debate. And that debate, any debate about China, has to affect American policy towards Taiwan. There will be temptations to somehow use the Taiwan issue as a way to toughen American policy. And I hope that doesn't happen.
Thank you, Steve. Provocative, and I like provocative arguments. We'll now turn to our last speaker, Dr. Zhao Xuesheng, who's professor and director of the Center for China-U.S. Cooperation at the Graduate School of International Studies at the University of Denver. Over to you, Sam.
Okay, thank you. It's no longer graduate school. It's a Colbert School. Joseph Colbert School.
Thank you for the correction. The bio that I was given must have been out of date. But thank you.
And I join other speakers to thank the Brookings Institution, Rich Bush, for putting together such a timely conference and having me be part of this timely conference, because this is really the right time to look back and look forward to see what has happened, and from that, what will happen in across Taiwan Strait relations and what impacts on the U.S. foreign policy. To look back, retrospect, I would say that the relationship has moved from crisis management to a new normal of peace and stability across the Taiwan Strait, and also a new normal of parallel improvements of relationship between China, Taiwan, between Taiwan and China. Before that was tensions among all three sides. But look forward. I see this new normal is very fragile. And why fragile? We'll talk about later on. But let me give you the conclusion just in case. because of those fragile and challenges, the conclusion to the three sides, in fact, the policy advice to three sides is that China side should be patient. Taiwan side should not make surprise, and U.S. stay on course. So this is my conclusion, just in case. Okay, let's go back to look back to the relationship of the three sides. Really, I think people have not given, maybe people in Taiwan have not given fair credits to Ma Ying-jeou, because look at Taiwan's policy debate today, not only domestic policies, they have not blamed to President Ma Ying-jeou and his administration. Even on a cross-strait relationship, which I think he accomplished so much, has also become so controversial at the last several years. In that context, we really have to look back to compare what Ma Ying-jeou has accomplished, the so-called new norm, versus pre-Ma Ying-jeou time. In fact, pre-Ma Ying-jeou time, those pre-2008 years, we saw three elections. I mean, since 1996, first Taiwan direct presidential election, crisis after crisis. During the 1996 election, we all know that before that, China had military exercise 3 months after Li Teng-hui visit United States. And then 2000, we saw the Taiwan Affairs white paper threatening using force, three conditions, I think one more condition to the old ones. And then 2004, we saw the anti-secession law just after the election. But at that time, although in those kind of crises, all sides were alarmed. And China side used the military forces. Taiwan side was preparing for the worst. And US and other countries in the region had to decide if they had to take sides with mainland China or with Taiwan or prepare for the war. So that was a very, very bad situation. And during that period, we saw a clear pattern leading to those crises. That is, when we said the relationship across the Taiwan Strait, which is three variables, Taiwan side, mainland China, and United States side, during that period, the Taiwan side, I think, was the most dynamic variable, driving force, in fact, taking advantage of democratization, taking advantage of Taiwan's economic wealth, and also international environment. The Taiwan's leaders at that time was very, very proactive. And China side was, in fact, at that time, reactive. And very, very often was taken by surprises. They had high expectations about Li Teng-hui because he did not involve into the civil war. He did not have the burden. That was talked to the Chinese leaders at that time, Li Tuzhu. So they had high expectation over him. Then they were surprised. Every time they surprised, they used military force. But every time when they used military force, they proved there was a brinkmanship, was not really ready to use military force. Why? Because militarily, they was not able. Because also their goal at that time was, emphasis was economic modernization, which were, the military force will hurt their modernization goal. And also, every time they find they backfired, every time they use the threat backfired, anyway, led the Taiwan people further and further away. So they, at end, decide they will refrain, they will step back every time. So from that perspective, those administrations, Li Teng-hui and Abian, was lucky from that perspective. although they provoked, did not have consequences. Then in a context, you should President Ma Ying-jeou administration came to office. What he has accomplished was much, much more difficult than his predecessors to accomplish. In fact, look back, 2008. When President Ma Ying-jeou came to office, China side was very, very suspicious, ambivalent toward Ma Ying-jeou. You talk to Chinese officials at time, they thought Ma Ying-jeou, he's a three no's, but one of no's is no unification. Could we trust him? But they quickly realized, in fact, many people in this room maybe tried to convince Chinese leaders there was really, really rare historical opportunity, window of opportunity. If you don't take that window of opportunity, the window will be closed. So they worked with Ma Ying-jeou administration. Ma Ying-jeou was also proactive, working with China. So eventually accomplished the so-called new norm. I see the new norm in many, many aspects. One is that non-official level. That really reached a very, very high level. Three links, all those things. Now we take for granted everything. At that time was very difficult to accomplish. From economy to politics, from easy part to difficult part, from non-official part to official part, all those kind of steps. You can see very smart, these people, on both sides. On the official level, mind you, tried mutual non-denials. Although China would not accept that, but at operational level, we really see Chinese has worked with the administration. They called each official title in the last several meetings. And also we see all those agreements at official level. And third, that international space, so-called, where Jiao Xiubin diplomatic truce, all those kind of accomplishments, mind you, came to Boston, to everywhere, was so different from the previous administrations. So this new normal was accomplished in a very difficult situation because the balance power across Taiwan Strait has shifted. The balance power between China and the US has shifted. The leadership in China has become much more proactive, much more aggressive, much more assertive. But Ma Ying-jeou administration successfully worked with this much, much more difficult administration, accomplished this new normal, new norms. So that's why I say these new norms are very difficult, but they are also fragile. Why fragile? This relates to the challenges. Let me mention four challenges that the three sides have to consider. The first challenge is that all easy parts, fruits, have been harvested so far. We have left those hard, difficult issues, peace negotiation, political negotiation, even on the economic front. A lot of issues now become much, much more difficult to accomplish. In the first couple of years, those ECFA, all those things was difficult, but it accomplished. Now the service trade agreement, for example, for those kind of issues, Taiwan side has more resistance. On China side, say, oh, we should not give that much to Taiwan. So that kind of issues become much more difficult to accomplish. Easy stage is over. Doesn't matter who come to office, DPP or KMT. They have to face a totally different, much more difficult situation to negotiate, to work with China. Second, the challenge is on the mainland China side. China is no longer, several people mentioned earlier, China is no longer the China before Ma Ying-jeou came to office today. Not only their whole policy orientation is changed, China used to be, for example, using foreign policy to serve domestic purpose, economic modernization. Now just reversed, using economic wealth, economic power to serve foreign policy objectives. Totally different now. At that time, why they did not use force? Because they heard economic modernization. Nowadays, the economic consequences are still important, but no longer as same important as used to be. Second, China used to be Tao Guang Yanghui, keeping no key, no profile. China no longer. China is very proactive now. Yuzhuozhuowei, not only yuzhuofenfayouwei, try to be really, really proactive on international affairs. Third, the balance power, as we mentioned, is no longer the same. Fourth, China has called very very assertive on the so-called core national interest. What is core national interest? Two definitions. One is bottom line of national survival. Second is non-negotiable, cannot compromise. So they now talk about South China Sea on those terms, because Taiwan Strait now is relatively peaceful. When Taiwan Strait comes to the spoiling point, that kind of definition makes the issue even more difficult to deal with. Third challenge on the Taiwan side, because DPP, I said her, dealing with her, but who is the her here? The her, if in my mind, doesn't matter who is her, the her. It really has to make sure no surprise to make it mention. Because DPP, at that time, the problem was surprise to both the mainland China and the Taiwan, making so many surprises. The new administration, whoever came to office, really has to be very calm, rational, try to make sure it's the continuity of the policy. Doesn't matter what can define the status quo, of course, it's very important. But here, the continuity is a very, very important. Predictable is a very, very important for Taiwan administration. So in that context, finally, for the U.S., U.S. has been doing, I think, very relatively well. So that's why I say U.S. should extend on course. What is on course? Let me say three no's. Three no's is a U.S. on course. Not take side, not take a position, not to mediate. These no's, I think, were really good no's. Makes really sense. Those no's assured the peace and stability. That is the objective of policy. So from that perspective, let me repeat my advices to all three sides. The China side should be patient. The Taiwan side should be no surprise. Taiwan, the US side, stay on course. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks to all of you for excellent, very thoughtful presentations. And the floor is now open for questions. Who would like to start? Mike Fonte, wait for the microphone, please.
Mike Fonte, I'm the DPP director of the Mission here. Thanks very much for the presentation. Steve, I'd like to give you a chance to explore that last question that you raised, the policy debate about the seriousness. I presume the not-so-serious debate that you talked about was abandoning Taiwan. I don't think that one is a serious debate. But since you have unlimited time now, maybe you could explore that last one, because I think that really is a very important debate. Ashley Tellis, Robert Blackwell, Mearsheim, all the stuff that's going on there. Thank you.
Well, Mike, if you were a student, if you were a student, I would say do the reading. But I'm not like Alexander. I'm not a commander in chief. As I read it, again, I'm outside the Beltway. Well outside the Beltway, thank God. But as I read it and as I talk to people, this whole concept of engagement, the whole concept of hedging, is really now under deep discussion, at least among think tanks. Is it worth continuing to try to engage China? Or is that a waste of time, given the fact that China is the stereotypical rising power, the so-called ascent of China, and that the only way to deal with China is to match China's power or build an alliance system? Mearsheim has got all kinds of ideas, but one key part of his ideas is that we're going to have to someday cut Taiwan loose, as you know. The other side, there are people who are saying, look, this is just one more difficult period in Sino-American relations. It's against the background of a relationship that's multifaceted, that can't be easily abandoned or subverted by either side. And anyway, we're on the verge of a visit in September by Xi Jinping, and China, as well as the United States, are going to try to do their best to somehow come back from what Mike Lampton again called the tipping point in the relationship. But I guess I'm sort of an old enough guy to remember that, you know, periodically these kinds of things happen. Richard Nixon said to at one point that talking about China, have I created a Frankenstein? During the 1990s, the end of the Clinton administration, the various charges against China, spying, interfering in elections. So there is kind of a pattern of crisis. But to get back to the late 90s again, there's no question that as Clinton tried after 1996 to rebuild the relationship with China against the background of a Republican Congress, that Taiwan became a very important part of the debate about dealing with China, and Congress was, whether they intended or not, whether the leadership intended or not, was provoking China with the Taiwan question. And I guess that's my concern, is that as a part of this debate, we'll get back to the point similar to the end of the Clinton administration. Congressman Salmon's comment that the one China that the one China policy is absurd. I don't think we have to hear much of that, or that the relationship that we have with Taiwan is absurd. We've got a very healthy relationship, and as somebody said this morning, a very deep military relationship. Actually, I think that somebody was the man who manages the relationship. So that's my concern. And we have an election coming. So it's beginning, you know, to rev up this kind of debate about China.
I would just add briefly that I think that a distinction needs to be made about the kind of debates or the parameters of the debate that are taking place inside the administration and outside the administration. And I think that there are differences between them that are important, and particularly this notion of engagement. We had an event at CSIS the other day where we had three senior people who were involved in the strategic and economic dialogue, and every one of them concluded what a useful process that is, and the outcomes that had been achieved that continue to shape the relationship and create opportunities for the two countries to cooperate. And there are conversations in new areas. And there's a long list, of course, of outcomes. I don't think anybody that I talk to in the administration argues against engagement with China. But I think there is a debate about how best to influence China's choices, to influence China's policies. And you have to look at discrete policies. How do you influence China's policy on the on some economic issues, like the negative list of the bilateral investment treaty? Or how do you influence China's behavior in the South China Sea? And so there are debates about what we might do or not do. But I don't hear anybody in the administration arguing against engagement, and yet there are. You cited the Blackwell, Ashley Tellis piece that favors containment, and I don't think that's a view that's held inside the administration. So there are definitely debates. I just think that one has to make a distinction about who's having them and what the parameters are of those debate and that those debates, and which ones matter and which ones don't. Other questions? Good, over here.
I'm Zhong Houtao, a visiting scholar in SES, Johns Hopkins University. Two questions. The first is for Professor Stephen Goldstein. Thank you very much for your wonderful definition for status quo. My question is about Dr. Tsai Ing-wen's maintaining status quo. Do you think she has the ability to maintain the status quo? Another question is for Professor Wang Yuengang. You were talking about U.S. rebalancing strategy, and then your point is quite thoughtful. So my question is, what's the Taiwan's role in U.S. Rebalancing strategy? Okay, thank you.
Let me answer a different question, and then I'll answer that question. Now I'm being a student, not a professor. If you don't know, if you don't know the answer to the question that's being asked, answer another question. I would begin by saying that any politician who is going to be elected president of Taiwan in 2016 is not going to be able to manage the mainland relationship with the same ease as the first 4 years of the Ma administration. Will Tsai Ing-wen do any worse? And I think my answer to that would be that it's up to the mainland. I think Tsai Ing-wen is not Chen Shui-bian, but she has a party. But more than that, she has public opinion on Taiwan. And public opinion on Taiwan, I think we just have to read those public opinion polls very carefully. And we have to conclude that any party is going to have a very difficult time steering cross-strait relations. The only advantage that a Kuomintang candidate might have is that they accept the 1992 consensus, so the mainland will talk to them. But I think Tsai Ing-wen is honest about wanting to maintain the status quo. I, as you know, since you were in on the meeting that I had in China, I've tried to tell the Chinese that they've got to give her a chance. They've got to listen. But that's up to China.
Okay. just briefly on the rebalance. there are two pillars to a rebalancing strategy. One is military pillar, and the strengthening alliances in East Asia. And second, economic pillar, that's the TPP. And in terms of military pillar, Taiwan is not officially part of it, but we see that there's that defense cooperation will still continue. And so Taiwan will become an important part of the rebalance, although the U.S. will not specifically say it as like Japan or South Korea's allies. And TPP, I think Kuei Bo has said that. and so I don't have much to add. But just quickly on the engagement thing, I'm not from the Beltway, so I'm free to offer a more academic view of it. And engagement, nobody will argue against engagement because it's a happy scenario that we all like to see, right? How can you argue against engagement, engaging a rising power? So I would, only a fool would argue against engagement. But there's another side to it, and that is that does China really wants to become like us, like United States or the West, right? Do we know what China wants, right? And engagement is based on the premise that we can socialize China into the existing rules of the game. Guess what? It's not happening, right? China has its own agenda. And also, it's also based on the assumption that we know what China wants. We know China's intentions. We can, you know, see how it behaves. We can know China's intentions. But what matters in international politics is capabilities, right? And so we always, when it comes to intentions, there's also always uncertainty about intentions. We can never know for sure. And even if we know today, it can still change in the future. So intentions as a guide to foreign policy, I don't think it's a very useful guide. What's a more useful guide is capabilities. And what's happening now is China's capabilities are rising. And that's what's causing, you know, a lot of changes today.
Other questions in the back?
Hi, my name is Chloe Pan, and I'm a rising sophomore at UCLA and current intern at the White House AAPI Initiative. My question is for Professor Goldstein. So earlier today, Scott Kennedy said that the TPP is exactly what we need to leverage China. So do you see the TPP as a sign of a conflicted status quo and even a sign of a new cool war between the United States and China as a way to contain growing Sino-economic influence?
I think there are people who are presenting the TPP like that. I think it shouldn't be presented like that, and I think it shouldn't be like that. But this idea of competing organizations and countering Chinese power by creating our own organizations, and China increasing its power by the Silk Road and the Silk Belt and the investment bank, all of that has the appearance of being a way to contain China or exclude China. But I think that would be a mistake, because any TPP that didn't include China would be a very, I think, weak TPP. Let me say something about engagement very quickly. What concerns me, and hedging is a kind of engagement, right? You hedge. You pursue a policy of both seeking initiatives, seeking better relations, while also preparing yourself for the worst. Hope for the best, prepare for the worst. Now, why do you pursue that policy? You pursue that policy because you don't trust the other side. The problem with engagement, or even mutual engagement, is because you don't trust the other side, the tendency is in interactions to take the what is perceived as the more aggressive actions of the other side as typical, and the more cooperative actions of the other side as not typical. So hedging really, if you don't trust the other side and you don't trust its intentions, you're going to assume that any actions that they take that are ambiguous are, by definition, aggressive. And so you never improve with hedging, but there's a real doubt that you can make things worse with hedging. And that's the challenge, I think, for Sino-American relations, is for each side. Each side is sending ambiguous signals about what their ultimate policies are. And because each side views the other as a potential opponent, we each tend to emphasize the more aggressive ambiguous signals and to dismiss the non-aggressive ambiguous signals as camouflage or something else. Thing is, how do you take the non-aggressive seriously and work with those and not the other kinds of signals? I think that's the challenge of engagement with China, not containment.
Richard, you have a question?
Just a comment on Steve's response to Mike Fonte. I think the more serious part of the debate about our relationship with China and our commitment to Taiwan has to do not with sort of general categories, but more the realities of China's changing military capabilities versus our military capabilities. And that if there were a conflict, does China have the capacity to project power in such a way that makes our forces vulnerable and makes it harder and harder to come to Taiwan's defense? That's just a comment. I'd like to ask a question about domestic politics. Clearly, Taiwan's domestic politics infuses all aspects of cross-strait policy. as Steve suggested, sometimes Taiwan and our commitment to Taiwan becomes an issue in U.S. politics, but not as much as it was, say, 20, 25 years ago. What my question has to do with politics in China and whether and how that affects Beijing's policy towards Taiwan. I'm not so worried about the politics of the masses, because I think Beijing can turn that off, turn that on as it wants. But it's more within the Communist Party, within the regime. And if a perception develops within Beijing that a new Taiwan president's intentions are a fundamental challenge to China's interests, what are the forces that are going to be unleashed on Xi Jinping to do something of a radical sort? Anybody who has an opinion can answer that question. Thanks.
Who wants to start?
I'll start by saying Xi Jinping has a lot of enemies, and he's making new ones every day. Losing Taiwan or being the Li Hongzhang of the 21st century is a charge that a disaffected group within the party could muster. And I agree with you, and I think we've probably heard others say this too, that you know the real danger for a concession on Taiwan doesn't come from the masses. It comes from a very small elite that is watching very carefully what the leader does and ready to spring on him, no hers in China, ready to spring on him if there's a mistake. And she has made a lot of enemies.
Let me address that question. I think for military is, the military is a very big unknown factor here. In fact, will be a driving force. Reading Chinese newspaper, I found an article by Nanjing Junxu, Nanjing Military Region, the vice commander, former vice commander Hong Guang, the lieutenant general. He had an article said, 大陆如何在战争中统一台湾，中国在战争打败台湾的总体规划, how China could unify with Taiwan by war. The grand strategy, how China could defeat Taiwan in a war. So these kind of articles in China has been circulating a lot. So military side has been pretty much driving this type of force, just like the South China Sea, those are the talk heads. Although you say they will not represent the Chinese government, but they reflect a very strong opinion within the elite. The elite side, I think, military is a very big force. But I don't know how the mass part turn on, turn off. But a Chinese leadership has not prepared for the mass on the Taiwan issue very well. In fact, they are really Chinese mass has been very poorly prepared for this issue now. I just talked to people from China on the two occasions. I found it very interesting. In last Sanheyi election, the 3-for-1 election, I talked to the Chinese side. Nobody predicted this kind of snide defeat by the KMT. Only very few individuals within the Taiwan study community, maybe one or two, predicted that. So they had an illusion. The KMT is still in a very powerful position. They can work with them. And now, in this election coverage in China, I was in Beijing in China talking to people. They overwhelmingly favor Hong Xiuzhu, the KMT candidate, and also they think she will win. I was so surprised. Everybody talked to me, oh, Xiao La Jiao, she's so spicy, and she's so active, she will win. I said, how could you get that kind of conclusion? Not too early, but looking at what's going on in Taiwan, but they still had those image. So they will be surprised again. If this surprise takes place again, you can imagine both from the elite and from the mass will be, I don't know what will happen at that point, the domestic dynamics.
They're not going to be surprised again. There are plane loads of American specialists going over to China and who will be going over to China in the next 4 or 5 months, presenting very different views of Taiwan politics.
But they don't want to listen. Don't want to believe.
Richard, I would just say in response to your very good question that I think that the tough remarks we have heard Xi Jinping state about Taiwan and cross-strait relations suggest that he's already shoring up his flank, that he doesn't want to be seen as soft on Taiwan. And so we're already seeing the direction that he will go if he sees that there is somebody in president in Taiwan who is challenging China's bottom line. So I share your concern. Yeah. All right, so we have time for one more question, I think. Maybe two. We'll see if it's short. Okay, this young woman right here. Yes.
Jing Zhen from Florida International University. My question is for Dr. Zhao and other panelists, if you have an opinion. Just now, Dr. Wan told us that the public support for unification in Taiwan is dwindling. So my question is whether time is on the mainland China side to achieve its goal of unification. And just now, Dr. Zhao mentioned that the mainland China side needs to be patient. But how being patient would help China to achieve unification? Thank you.
I think that for quite a long time, I mean, before my NGO side, China was not patient because they thought time was not quite on their side. After my NGO, I think they understand more and more on the issue that time is on their side, indeed, because of the balance power shift, because of the trend across Taiwan Strait, and also because of China's relationship with other, with the U.S. and other powers. Everything eventually will come to their favor. I think that's why I said they should be patient. Whether they can be patient, that's another issue, because of all the surprises will really make them and lost their patience. In fact, that looking at Xi Jinping, his talk on both sides. On one side is 心灵契合, he talks about heart to heart, this kind of talking very, very, if you think he's so generous, so kind of patient, so try to work with the Taiwan people. On the other hand, you listen to him talking about cannot leave this issue to the next generation. And those kind of talks on both sides. So really, I think if I advise the Chinese leaders, I would say stay on their course of modernization to be patient. Not only on Taiwan issue, also on the issue with China, with the United States and their neighbors. Since 2009, 2010, they have lost all their past. I mean, not only patience, all their foreign policy achievement, put there in a very, very awkward position. I mean, even Yi Lu, that one road, one bell, I think it's totally wrong. I mean, talking to those people in China party circle, I was in China last three trips in last month, talking to even those kind of hardline realists. They talk about, wei, jiao da yao jin, foreign policy, greatly forward. How could China can afford all those kind of big, big money? I asked one person, how can you think China could put those money? He couldn't, be quiet. Because we never implement our agreements. Only 17%, 履约率, 70% all our signed contracts came to true. Yeah. If we commit $100 million, only $17 million will come up. So it's 大忽悠 in China. So you see what's going on in China. You'll be surprised.
Okay, well, I think we've reached about the end of our panel. I'm going to turn the floor over to Huang Kuo-bo for some closing remarks. But before I do, please join me in thanking everybody on the panel.
Okay, I would like to thank all of you for coming
to this very interesting and meaningful conference on cross-Taiwan trade relations. First, on behalf of the Association of Foreign Relations, founded in December 2013 in Taipei, I would like to thank the other co-hosts, Center for East Asia Policy Studies and John Thornton, China Center at Brookings, and Freeman Chair in China Studies at CSIS. Without them, we couldn't have this very successful conference in Washington, D.C. today. And secondly, I would like to extend my gratitude to the Mainland Affairs Council of the ROC Executive for providing financial sponsorship to the association so that we can organize a six people delegation to Washington. You know, that costs a lot. So thanks to MAC. And last but not least, is that we, all the co-hosts, would like to thank with our deepest appreciation to the audience, especially some of whom have attended from early morning today. And actually, all of you have come to the right place, but in the wrong timing. Wrong timing means it's Monday morning, it's summer vacation Monday morning, and it's drizzly morning. But I really thank you all for coming here, even if the factors, as I mentioned, you know, were so inappropriate for these kind of big conferences. So anyway, so that being said, please allow me to announce the end of the conference and wish you all the best. Thank you very much.